Hello, everyone. This is Kay Tenenbaum with another edition of the Saturday Evening Post. Here's a message from the editors. Engage, educate, empower, inspire the Saturday Evening Post's mission. We know Post readers love a great story. Here's ours. The Saturday Evening Post is not just a magazine. We are a nonprofit with a mission to advance the literary and visual arts and to improve the quality of life for people of all ages in mind, body, and spirit. Our publications. Generations of Americans have turned to the Saturday Evening Post for great fiction, art, humor, and inspiration, and as a trusted source for news and ideas. And generations of young readers have turned to our award-winning youth magazines, Jack and Jill and Humpty Dumpty, designed to spark children's curiosity and encourage creativity and learning. Our programs, Preserve and Share. Over the past decade, the Post has digitized its 200-year-old archive, an invaluable collection of over 3,500 cover illustrations and a 500,000 magazine pages featuring iconic writers and artists, and made it available online, SaturdayEveningPost.com/issues. Honor and Celebrate. The Great American Fiction Contest honors the Post legacy of featuring renowned American authors, Fitzgerald, Faulkner, Oates, Bradbury, and many more, by finding compelling new stories and the authors behind them. SaturdayEveningPost.com/fiction-contest. Educate and empower. The Forever Fit Summer Camp, FFSC, is a comprehensive evidence-based program for youth launched in 2013 to address the public health crisis of childhood obesity. The American Academy of Pediatrics selected an abstract on FFSC for presentation during the 2019 American Academy of Pediatrics National Conference and Exhibition. Engage and Inspire. The annual U.S. Kids Art Contest encourages children's creativity and fosters the exploration of new ideas, subject matter, and cultures. Each year, hundreds of children share their creative talents. The winning entry is featured on the front covers of Jack and Jill and Humpty Dumpty magazines, and the winner's school's art departments receive cash awards. We couldn't do it. The Saturday Evening Post Society is a nonprofit organization primarily funded by our members. To make a tax-deduction donation, visit SaturdayEveningPost.com/donate. Here's how to browse our 200-year-old archive free for subscribers. Go to SaturdayEveningPost.com/link. Enter your 16-digit account number found on your mailing level between the hashtag symbols or the email address you used when you subscribed to the Post or your full mailing address. Click the link button. Check your email for your username and password, and then dive into nearly 200 years of American history. Not a member? Join online today at SaturdayEveningPost.com/subscribe. And now here are the letters to the editor. What Our Kids Need to Know. Your editor's letter, Teach Your Children Well, September and October, got me wondering not just about history, but about whose stories we will teach and how. What would a modern curriculum teach about the 12 U.S. presidents who owned slaves? Jefferson's relationship with slave Sally Hemings, or how Andrew Jackson thought the Trail of Tears was a good idea. If the country is to become one nation, your closing paragraph rings true. It bothers in our interest and in our power to make history come alive for the next generation. That was written by Robert J. Gill, The Villages, Florida. Sharing the Lamp of Experience, September-October, is an eye-opener. As a retiring National Park Service Ranger, I have struggled to rekindle a passion for history, especially among our children. That came from Kevin Hanley, an email. faster than a speeding hippo. In the 2009 World Championships, Usain Bolt set a world record of 9.58 seconds for the 100-meter event, about 27 miles per hour. In Not-So-Gentle Giant Vault, September-October, you state that the hippopotamus can run at a speed of up to 30 miles per hour. Is this a typo? That came from Aaron Busick from Springfield, Missouri. Editor's note, despite their massive bulk, hippos actually can run faster than humans, up to 30 miles per hour in short bursts. Music to my ears. I enjoyed Three Questions with Brian Setzer, posted September-October, way back in 1982, when the M in MTV still stood for music rather than meh. I remember falling in love with Brian Setzer and the Stray Cats. His music is timeless. That was written by Christy Brown Weber, an online comment. Leaving a mark. In The Signpost in My Life, September-October, Todd Pidduck wrote about his efforts to memorialize his cremated father by placing a marker with an epitaph on his uncle's tombstone. I have faced the same dilemma. Both of my parents chose cremation and wanted their ashes spread over the Pacific Ocean coastal area. I have decorated the graves of various ancestors on Memorial Day, but could not do so for my own parents. I, too, settled on a cemetery marker near a fountain installed in memory of my parents' best friends. While a short epitaph can't begin to describe the rich and fulfilling lives my parents lived or their contributions they made to humanity, the marker gives me a tangible place to spread flowers once a year. That was written by Marvin F. Case from Vancouver, Washington. Protection racket. I read with interest the safety police argument, September-October, on stifling freedom of expression and creativity on college campuses. The idea that danger lurks everywhere runs rampant through our society. On the opposite end of the spectrum from students are elders who live in retirement or nursing homes whose lives are overly circumcised to protect them from danger. As someone who has worked in nursing homes for over 20 years, I've seen how, in the name of safety, residents are 1. Not able to share home-baked brownies, 2. Are not permitted to use mechanical devices such as sewing machines, 3. Can't use sharp objects such as scissors and needles, 4. Can't keep genealogy scrapbooks because of the possible fire hazard. As an employee, I once received disciplinary action because I allowed a resident to put his own cup holder on his wheelchair instead of insisting the modification be done by a contracted wheelchair repair person. The issue of safety has become one of overreach, affecting the personal freedoms of our elders. That was written by Lawrence Molzik in Nebraska. In defense of autumn, I cannot agree with the bad rap that the season gets in fall out of favor, lighter side, September-October. In my part of the country, fall is a welcome reprieve from summer heat and humidity, the start of another school year for our children, deep blue skies and falling leaves that replenish the soil, the thrill of football for millions of fans, the best of our national holidays, Thanksgiving, not to mention my birthday. Please get fall back in favor and celebrate every single season, every single day, every single minute of the year. Written by Sandra Balcom Height from Wilson, North Carolina. The Price is Wrong. Sneaker Madness by Capo Newhouse, American Pop, September and October, opened my eyes to a whole new world. Until now, I've been throwing away my old sneakers. That came from Jabba Gupta, an online comment. Anyone rich enough to burn $1,590 on a pair of shoes has way too much money. Written by Bob McGowan Jr., online comment. Smart Puppy. Never has a headline been so specific or the photo of the aptly named Hunter been so on target as in Good Dog, September, October, introducing us to the wonderful joint effort by Wilma Melville and Paul Lobo. Love those border collies. Great job by the team. Written by Patrick McKelvey, Bella Vista, Arkansas. The Military's Medical Care. I am writing this letter after reading Military Malpractice. You be the judge, July, August. I believe the military was wrong and the Supreme Court decision was biased because of the mostly male makeup of its members. Any woman in the most vulnerable position of giving birth would agree that there are exceptions to every rule of law that must be considered, and U.S. Navy Lieutenant Rebecca Daniels' situation was certainly one of them. Written by Carol Lee Britton Pete from Chico, California. Mercat Moment. As I turned the page to see my life as a meme in my life, July, August, I was about laughing my head off. I love anything concerning mercats. They are highly intelligent species. They take care of their own. They do sentry duty. Notice that the one on the author's head has turned his head clear around backwards. Congratulations on this wonderful story. Send your letters to letters at SaturdayEveningPost.com or letters, The Saturday Evening Post, 3520 Guyon Road, G-U-I-O-N Road, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46222. That's 3520 Guyon Road, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46222. And now, The Argument by Stephen Perlstein. Unfair Disadvantage. Because local property taxes fund public schools, the system often punishes those who live in low-income neighborhoods. Their schools get less funding, shoddier facilities, and less effective teachers. No moral intuition is more hardwired into Americans' conception of economic justice than equality of opportunity. While some of us may be rich and others poor, we are willing to accept such outcomes as long as everyone has an equal shot at success. The moral legitimacy of the market's distribution of income rests on a presumption that our system rewards ingenuity, hard work, talent, and risk-taking rather than race, class, family connections, or some other advantage we consider unearned, illegitimate, or unfair. In every wise struggle for human betterment, one of the main objects, and often the only object, has been to achieve in large measure equality of opportunity, declared President Theodore Roosevelt in a speech in Kansas in 1910, laying out the square deal he believed was due to all Americans. In a speech later that year, Roosevelt took pains to reassure members of the New Haven Chamber of Commerce that his notion of equal opportunity fits squarely within the context of a market economy. I know perfectly well that men in a race run at unequal rates of speed. I don't want the prize to go to the man who is not fast enough to win it on his merits, but I want them to start fair. Equality of opportunity, of course, taps into the conception Americans have of themselves as a people who fought one war to shake off the tyranny of a British monarchy and aristocracy, and another to shake off the chains of slavery, a people who welcomed wave after wave of ambitious immigrants yearning for a better life. Yet there is now a sizable and growing body of evidence that, despite elimination of most legal barriers to equality of opportunity, the luck of which parents you were born to continues to play an outsized role in determining economic success. Whether it's by way of the genes we inherit, nature, or the circumstances in which we are raised, nurture, the results of this parental lottery are more important than ever in determining our natural capabilities and the degree to which we are able to develop those capabilities and bring them to an increasingly competitive marketplace. Indeed, for the first time in American history, the steady march toward greater equality of opportunity seems to be headed in the opposite direction. Our educational system is no longer serving its historic role of equalizing economic opportunity and increasing social mobility. Rather, it has become an instrument by which children, lucky enough to be born into favorable circumstances, increase their economic advantage over those who were not. It was 65 years ago that the Supreme Court, relying largely on evidence and expert opinion from social scientists, ruled in Brown v. Board of Education that sending black children to separate schools was inherently unequal. Now it is time to extend that constitutional principle and declare that it is no longer acceptable to organize and finance public education in a way that segregates poor children in separate schools. Because of our reliance on local property taxes to fund public schools and public school systems that organize schools around residential neighborhoods, we have a system that in many places provides less funding, less effective teachers, and worse facilities to poor students who require more resources and better teachers to reach comparable educational goals. Moreover, there is clear evidence from social science research that segregating poor children in the same schools deepens their disadvantage. The only practical way to end this class segregation is education in the same way racial segregation was ended, with a Supreme Court finding that segregating poor students in the same schools denies them the equal protection of the law guaranteed by the Constitution. As it happens, the Supreme Court explicitly rejected that view in 1973 in a case that few remember today, San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez. In a 5-4 ruling, the court, which only two decades before, in Brown, had recognized the importance of public education to a democratic society and a child's success in later life, reversed course and declared that public education was not a fundamental right under the Constitution. It also found that discrimination on the basis of class did not warrant the same strict scrutiny as discrimination on the basis of race. Writing for the majority, Justice Lewis Powell worried that if public education were to be treated as a fundamental right, the court would find itself on a slippery slope that would also require it to give similar status to housing and medical care. It is time to revisit those issues. One reason is new evidence from social science studies showing that socioeconomic characteristics of a child's classmates are a better predictor of educational achievement than a child's own socioeconomic background. Another is the change in case law. In the intervening years, there has been a long line of court decisions striking down affirmation actions, plans at universities, or guaranteeing parents control over their children's schooling, in which the court's conservative majority recognized something that sounds very much like a constitutional right to education. With a series of education reform bills, Congress has also established a strong federal interest in ensuring that all students attain minimal levels of educational achievement, with a particular emphasis on low-performing students and school districts. All of these developments provide a solid legal basis to ask the court to recognize the issue and declare that Rodriguez was wrongly decided. There is nothing sacred about the idea that municipalities and school districts have to have the same boundaries, or the public education needs to be funded primarily through property taxes. To assure equal access to an adequate education, the federal courts could require states to redraw school district boundaries in ways that would end desegregation by class and put rich and poor students in the same school systems. Courts could order states to devise statewide funding formulas that would begin to break the pernicious link between local property values, per-pupil spending, and educational achievement. And judges could even insist that the newly redrawn school districts rely on student choice for school assignments and make extensive use of magnet schools. I don't underestimate the political and legal difficulties in bringing about such a radical restructuring of public education. I am old enough to remember the bruising battles over busing, and I am aware that the process of bringing racial integration to public schools has hardly been a smashing success. Class integration would be no less challenging, but it is also no less of a moral imperative. It is worth recalling that the campaign to overturn the separate but equal doctrine in Plessy versus Ferguson energized a generation of Americans in the 1960s. Overturning Rodriguez and establishing the fundamental right of all children to a decent education could be the legal issue that energizes a new generation eager to ensure that history continues to bend towards justice. It will take patience, persistence, and political courage, but this is the kind of defined moral issue that is worth the effort. Stephen Perlstein is a Washington Post columnist and the Robinson Professor of Public Affairs at George Mason University. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 2008 for columns anticipating and explaining the financial crisis and global economic downturn. American Pop by Cable Newhouse. The Quiet Diet. The price of modernity is a constant assault of bleeding, clanging, whirring, and buzzing. Here's a worthy challenge. Try escaping the daily din of American life. It's not easy. Maybe, for instance, you don't actually want to hear Wolf Blitzer's voice blaring from every TV planted in a public space. Who'd blame you? Unfortunately, most of us are constantly assaulted by a never-ending bleeding, clanging, whirring, and buzzing, the raucous background music of 21st-century civilization. It's more than merely annoying, which would be plenty bad enough. It also undermines our ability to work productively. Worse, it may be doing harm to our brains. With the cacophony is not an entirely new phenomenon, except the chirps of our omnipresent tech devices, it nevertheless constitutes a palpable torture for many of us. You know the androgynous figure who expresses universally understood agony in Edvard Munch's famous painting, The Scream? Well, then you get the idea. The most troubling part of noise pollution is that it can result in permanent hearing loss, anxiety, and hypertension. Some say even coronary artery disease. Such trauma. At the very least, don't we all badly need some alone time where we can focus? An obviously good idea, I'd say. It is hardly a surprise, then, that so many of our fellow Americans seek refuge in the isolation of parks and forests. Noise is, of course, a serious problem, chiefly in urban areas. It was in New York City, unsurprisingly, where she could no longer abide the background roar that Julia Barnett Rice, wife of a wealthy businessman, founded the Society for the Suppression of Unnecessary Noise. That was 113 years ago. Mark Twain signed on as spokesperson for the group. Its one lasting legacy, the widespread adoption of legally enforced quiet zones around schools and hospitals. But even far from our cities, anti-noise battles rage. Those who lead the charge, arguing for better noise abatement legislation and community among oft-disrespectful neighbors, do so with increasingly evidence to support the cause. These days, they can bring to their campaigns evidence showing that quiet is provably beneficial. 6 years ago, the journal Brain Structure and Function published a study indicating that mice, when exposed 2 hours of silence every day, developed new cells in the region of the brain that controls memory, emotion, and learning. not exactly a duh moment in the annals of laboratory experimentation, but a revelation nevertheless. Additionally, recent studies with humans offer yet more support for those of us who believe that quiet is among our basic human rights, the right to maintain our personal well-being. People who meditate, this research has found, often see a significant delay in the onset of brain deterioration. In essence, by carving out a quiet interlude every day, meditators remain intellectually youthful longer. These discoveries free those of us who long for a quieter country to confront our neighbors about such matters as dogs that just will not stop barking, or, more urgently, streaming rappers who just will not stop rapping. At the very least, in our cranky way, we can present actual science to explain why the noise sets us off. All we want, after all, are fresh brain cells. And then there is the enduring mystery of what's known as the hum, an anomalous, barely detectable noise heard almost everywhere around the world. Does it come from electromagnetic signals? Underground pipelines? No one knows. But scientists keep looking into the hum. However bad it is, in my opinion, it's not nearly as maddening as many amateur YouTube videos. So, for now, I choose to sit in quiet, when possible, and blissfully ignore its existence. In the last issue, Cable Newhouse wrote about luxury sneakers. Dear Idiot, this is The Lighter Side by Philip Gully. My earliest published work did not always receive the highest magnitude of praise. I got my start in writing at the age of 23 when I phoned the Indianapolis News to complain about the inspirational thought they published each day. The operator passed me on to the editor, who told me the job was mine if I thought I could do better. I hadn't been angling for a job, but it was only two sentences a day and paid $50 a month. So I rightly interpreted it as a sign from God that I should be a writer. I had just entered college, so while writing the daily devotional, I was also picking up roadkill for the Indiana Department of Highways to pay for my education. There's nothing like picking up dead possums to keep one from getting the big head that often accompanies seeing one's name in print. I liked writing for the newspaper because it allowed me the luxury of fresh commentary. I'd have a thought one day and see it on the front page of the news the next. When I start a book, I'm 2 years away from holding it in my hands. When I write an essay for a magazine, it won't see the light of day for at least 3 months. It's now July, and I'm having to write about what life might hold in November and December. Lacking a crystal ball makes my job somewhat tricky. I can't say it's been a rainy fall, since fall hasn't arrived, nor can I write with certainty about political matters, since by November the British might invade us and take us back. I've been wary of the British since they burned the White House in 1814. Writing with an eye to the future imposes a certain caution I don't always exhibit in other areas of my life. I can't just spout off like a guy sitting at a bar with six beers in him. That's not to say I haven't written dumb things. I once penned a column about realtors and their occasional habit of exaggeration. For the next year, I received letters and emails from honked-off realtors around the country, most of them beginning with the salutation, "Dear Idiot." Being in print is a heady experience, so if you're not careful, you start thinking you're an expert on all matters and don't mind telling people so. We're brought down to earth by people who call us idiots, which is probably healthy. Despite the occasional contempt in which writers are held, I meet a lot of people who want my job, though most of them aren't willing to do the work necessary for the task. Writing might be the only vocation like this. No one says, "I want to be a brain surgeon," and then slices into someone's head, but lots of folks will peck out an essay, declare themselves writers, and expect the Pulitzer Prize to land on their doorstep the next day. Writing is funny that way. That wraps up this session of the Saturday Evening Post. I'm Kate Tenenbaum. See you next week.